beat people with no nuclear weapons, not radio medical isotopes.
But the IAEA was not subject to the accusations that UNSCOM was subject to of having governments placed.
I think that's right, although there were accusations made against people, including myself, that there were people on the team who were operating as intelligence agents. And that's really got to be separated two ways. If one definition of intelligence is you're trying to find out something that other people are trying to keep you from finding out, all teams were intelligence. I mean, if the Iraqis had lived up to their obligation under 687 and presented everything that they were supposed to, there would have been no need for this. The dynamic of discovery and consequently of access to intelligence was a result of an Iraqi decision not to come clean.
Let me go back again to Bahrain, where there were, I think, at least two installations. Now, was IAEA involved in those or not? There was the US-UK one, which was
In the UNSCOM facility, one that was at the airport, or eventually became centered around the airport, the IAEA was asked to use it. I always used it.
You did.
On every inspection, Dmitry hated to do it. He thought it was a symbol, and Zipporel thought it was a symbol of the UNSCOM's power, that it was a chaos. He was insisting that we go through it. As we staged mixed teams, the one time we staged a team, it was the very first inspection, not my first, but the very first inspection. We staged it from Vienna, got the teams there. We didn't have the facilities. It was a long, horrendous flight. It just didn't work out. And so what was eventually done by those teams that did not stage through Bahrain, I thought was unacceptable. They would just meet in the hotel and then go from there. And that didn't forge a team either. With regard to the other facility, which was a support facility eventually became more than the U.S. and the U.K., but that was its origin, was certainly the U.S. and U.K. I used it with my teams for briefing and debriefing. The intelligence communities would not brief at the UNSCOM unprotected facility, or they wouldn't brief up to a level that was very useful. If you went into their facility, and I took not just Americans, I took a declared KGB agent. I knew he was declared, but you probably remember him because he was head of the IAEA office in New York, and while he was out of the country, the New York Times outed him on the front page, and so he didn't come back, but he later showed up as the Russian commissioner, and I took him, it was the first Russian taken into Iraq, I took him in on one of my teams. I took him into the facility to be briefed. I said, he's a member of the team, I need him briefed. Yeah. You're going to brief him. And they said, bring him in. And I also used it selectively for an after-action debrief. After we came out of Baghdad, in addition to the written reports, the communities, the intelligence communities supporting the IAEA and UNSCOM, and I think this may be what made much of the difference in the chemistry between myself and Dmitry and others, intel guys, particularly in a hard target like Iraq, they're mostly staring at photos and they're listening to what little communications they can intercept and trying to read the tea leaves of defectors and all that. They get a very strange picture of reality. And the only way that becomes a better picture is if someone who has access goes back, collects information, tells them that, feeds it, and then the next time they give you information, it'll be a little bit better. And unless you have this cycle, they feed you, but you also feed them, and that's the only way you get improvement. And to me, that seemed not illogical, it seemed in my self-interest. I really wanted the information they gave me the next time I went in to be better than it was what they gave me on the previous mission.
Which means it was natural that the information that you found went back to national governments.
It went back to national governments as well as to the IAEA UNSCOM. Now, that second facility, was I didn't go there because some American told me to go there. I went there because Ralph Achaeus told me to go there. And so I did it under instructions. And so it was not a case of an American national or some other national on his own deciding to report to government. Unscom said, you go there because we depend on them. I said, absolutely, I understand that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I want better information next time I go in than they gave me this time. And so it was that method. And I chalk it up, less to, there was a certain level of personal animosity between Blix and Achaeus. It goes back to Swedish politics, which, I mean, Bob Gallucci and I always used to joke. And finally, once we asked both of them, every time they spoke in Swedish, the chemistry got bad. And we spent the next day trying to straighten it out. And once he and I agreed, and we both did at the same time, we asked them not to speak in Swedish. Because we figured in English, and it's true, it never, at least when they spoke English, it didn't get as bad. But part of it was that the people in Vienna had little experience with dealing with intelligence, always thought someone else was holding back on them, didn't understand the dynamic of if this intelligence is really bad, help them react, because you don't have to, they've got access to things you don't have, and try to work with them. Now, some of the intel people were easier to work with than others. The U.S. did not do a good job. The first person they provided was excellent. A woman, we called her, call sign was Mother when we had to deal with her on open telecommunications. The second and third person they put in were not as good and were suspicious and more a little bit more antagonistic than they should have been.
Let me ask you something in that connection. Scott Ritter has said that he insisted on going to the Israelis because the Israelis were much better at reading imagery than the Americans were, and that they also had certain capacities that no other country had. Were you still there when that happened?
No, when I was there, in fact, we were in the effort to broaden our information. None of us were comfortable having to rely entirely on the U.S. or the U.S. and the U.K. We tried, I was involved in trying to get the French, for example, and the Russians. The Russians, even though I took the first one in, they wouldn't tell you anything systematic. He got a little better after one of the things forgotten is that when Gorbachev was seized and the coup took place, the first foreign country to congratulate the inept coup plotters was Saddam Hussein, who sent a cable. And so immediately after that, we got better cooperation, but it was still awfully spotty, and I always remained suspicious that the Russians knew a lot more. They must have. They were in the country more than we had been, and we tried to... I have to be honest, I was troubled and I expressed trouble. The more we got into the dependence on intelligence, I knew, I'd spent my whole life in and around the UN. I knew the culture. I knew it was going to be a problem. I knew there were ways you could work it, but the more you formalized it, the more deeply and more dependent on you became, you couldn't look the other way. Vienna was, I must say, awfully lucky, although I don't know how many times in my life I've walked across the street from the U.S. mission. It was convenient when you were there doing it. The perception it created and the fact that the intel community would not brief in the U.N. Secretary building, but insisted that the briefings be carried out at least at the mission. They were always comfortable with the mission, but at least at the mission. Created a symbolism that I thought was unfortunate and shouldn't have been. For example, when they came to Vienna, they would not brief in the UN building in Vienna. They insisted that we go out to the mission for a briefing. I thought that was real stupidity, because they had to operate on the basis that anything they told us would eventually get out to anyone anyway. Why not come and brief it there? Now, operationally, I guess I appreciated the pressure they were under, but the symbolism was just awful. But at least during my period, it was primarily, there was a little of French provided, actually Germans provided a reference to missiles in a couple of the nuke areas. But by and large, it was a U.S. UK winner.
How long were you there, Dave?
I left after my third mission, which was the parking lot mission, when I was, Blix said, you know, that's your last one, you can't go in again. And I said, well, I can't do that. Like to go somewhere else. I wanted to, I guess it was the academic in me in some ways. I was afraid that the inspection process was going to be corrupted. I knew if I couldn't lead inspections, I was probably better off being on the outside where I could speak freely. It was just, so I chose to do that. So I left in the, it was, oh, let me see. I think I technically left about January of the second year, January, February.
Of 92?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the to your contact with the Iraqi nuclear scientists. You mentioned Jafar. In this relatively early stage, did you have contact?
Oh, yes. We were very fortunate. The Iraqis were inexperienced at handling it. Not only with Jafar, we had the number two person, the one who first needed to see us was an American trained nuclear scientist, had a PhD from Michigan State. And we had daily contact with him. With the others, we had routine contact. It took the Iraqis a while to learn. Most of the scientists spoke excellent English. So we would engage in technical conversations with them, and they would engage in it. And they occasionally let very important information slip. They answered, they got caught up and answered a technical question fully. I guess it was the end of the second mission, because there was a major slip up by an Iraqi on the second mission. They started to insist that they only speak in Arabic and that they do the translations. But no, Jafar, we had long conversations with him. Jafar was, the most important one was probably, it was on the second mission, in which late at night we were summoned to his office. He had two offices. The second office, and the actually more important office, was in the Ministry of Industry and Military Production. That's an English translation of it. Very large ministerial office. He was the number two there. And we had a set of questions we wanted to ask him and go through, and we went through, dialed. We were about ready to leave, and this must have been close to midnight. And he said, you know, we could have developed, and this was in a period in which they were still denying that they had a nuclear weapons program. He said, you know, we could have done a nuclear weapon if we'd wanted to. We were smart enough, and we knew everything. And then he launched in, no other question, didn't give a chance for a follow-up question, launched into a full technical description of how, if they had wanted to, they would have done a nuclear weapons program. Well, he gave away information that only if you had actually done it, you would not have learned this from a book, could do it. And I mean, we were flabbergasted. He was conflicted. He's a man of the West. In fact, he was an eminent scientist, which you can't claim anyone would have been a Nobel Prize. That's a crapshoot. But he certainly would have, if he had stayed strictly with physics in the West, have been one of the world's top physicists today. Drawn back into this dirty nuclear program with most of his friends cut off and his reputation as a physicist not respected, it really stopped when he left CERN and left the West, stopped attending CERN conferences. He wanted us to know how good he was. And that was, it was a fatal mistake. Another one of those fatal mistakes in really just revealing even more to us about their program than we knew and opening up avenues of inspection. So yes, we had, it tightened down after that mission. But they continued to provide not the routine sort of deep, they got more control over it, but the first three inspections, well, the first two inspections, we had pretty full access to.
Mm-hmm. Now, were all of them pretty much Western trained?
Most were. There were a younger generation. They'd start, and when we say physics, they started giving PhDs at the University of Baghdad in the early 80s. So the younger generation, and that was during the time of the Iran-Iraq war when they were also controlling people going out. So there was a younger generation that was almost entirely trained.
But you didn't find Soviet-trained physicists.
No, and we asked them about that. There were some who were East German trained, mm-hmm. but not Moscow trained. They were quite frank. The best training was in the West. Their preference was to go to the U.S. They couldn't go to the U.S., they'd go to the U.K. They liked Germany, West Germany, and only otherwise would they go somewhere else in the bloc. Mm-hmm. Now they were... it disturbed us because we couldn't believe it mm-hmm. at first. Why hadn't they? But that was their story and they stuck to it, and we didn't find a lot of contrary evidence to that, that there was a cadre of Soviet-trained scientists never dropped out.
Yes. You touched on this before. I just wanted to pursue it a little bit, this Soviet question, because the Soviets had a pretty good friendship at that point. There were supposedly all sorts of scientific exchanges, and I think the Soviets did at that time quite legally sell them some equipment that was
yes.
related. My question is, what evidence did you find of that Soviet connection in the nuclear field?
We did find some equipment, not a great deal, not as much as they procured from the West, mm-hmm. Not as critical as they had. Here again, their argument was, look, we were paying top dollar. We knew that the best equipment was in the West. If we couldn't go to the West, we tried to get it from Asia on equipment. That was their second choice. We only went to the Soviets when we couldn't get it. I think partly this is, the Iraqis are an extremely proud people, competent. They were scientifically very competent. Most of them had been trained in the West, so they grew. None of us who were trained in the West studied on Russian equipment, Soviet equipment. In fact, it probably had an unfair reputation as being second-rate equipment. But, you know, you tend to use what you learn as a graduate student. You don't go out and try new stuff. So they placed orders. They wanted the exact scales and other stuff that they had seen in Western institutions. So there was not a lot of evidence. The weapons route they pursued that we know of, the two major ones, and there were three or four other minor ones, the Calutron program was a U.S. program. The Soviets had pursued it, but quickly abandoned it because they gained espionage evidence on the gaseous diffusion plant and went that way and then went to centrifuges. The plans that they used for their Calutrons were U.S. plans, that we know. The building was one laid out, at Tormillo was one laid out like a building at Oak Ridge. So that had U.S. fingerprints all over it. The centrifuges that they used were based on a German, Dutch, U.K. design they had gained by access to the consortium Urinco that runs that program. It was not a Russian centrifuge design at all. So there's just not much evidence there of it. Yes, and you know, it was one we all pursued because we all had suspicions. We all knew the Soviets had been there, that there had been close military cooperation in some areas. It just wasn't there in the new program.
Now, while you were still there, had the IAEA, together with INSCOM, begun to think about the permanent monitoring system?
The first permanent monitoring plan was written while I was still there. And we were negotiating various aspects of it between, mostly negotiations were between IAEA and UNSCOM, who had quite different views of it. It primarily related to the issue. The IAEA's perspective was UNSCOM and the inspections, the IAEA part of the inspections, are abnormal. We must quickly return to the safeguard thing. And that was partly Blix negotiating these political shoals. The board as a whole and the general conference, you know, safeguards were something the majority reluctantly went on because if they didn't, they wouldn't get technical assistance. Mm-hmm. The intrusiveness, and it became more intrusive as the Iraqis decided to confront, was acultural. it caused problems. Blix himself wanted to get back as quickly as possible to the norm. Unscombe, on the other hand, saw this as almost an open-ended issue. After, for example, our second inspection, the Security Council passed a resolution which, among other things, said that Iraq could never have a research reactor again until some uncertain time in the past, no nuclear program, and that was an issue of considerable consternation in Blix.
Yeah, I noticed that. Let me just ask, were there any nuclear power plants?
No, the Iraqis had had plans for nuclear power plants, as had the Shah of Iran, but the economics and the Iran-Iraq war had interrupted that. So all they had were research reactor. But they certainly had on the books, they had aspirations for one. But the Security Council not only ruled out power plants, they ruled out research reactors. So most of the pressure, at least when I was there, a contention between the IA and UNSCOM related to the extent of invasiveness, permanence, intrusiveness of this sort of program.
Yes, I did notice that though the first plan that I think Blix presented for a permanent monitoring system did provide for unannounced.
Yes, by that point, you know, here again it's amazing. We went from a place during my first inspection there from where no one was permitted to do unannounced inspections. And in fact, if I hadn't found anything, I think I would have been out of a job right then, because it was a real break with tradition. When I got back to Vienna after that first mission, which I think most of us viewed as a success, I had IAEA safeguard inspectors tell me I shouldn't have done it, I put their life in danger, people wouldn't think that they would do unannounced inspections, didn't I realize they couldn't get away with unannounced inspections, etc. And even I had Americans when I came here who work out at the on-site inspection agency, who are the inspectors in the bilateral agreements we have with what was then the Soviet Union, now Russia. They too were, because in the bilaterals there are now unannounced inspections. It was a real break with the history of arms control, because arms control had been a carefully constant, it was a minuet that was very formal, and all the hard issues were during the negotiations. The assumption was, if you ever conclude an agreement, then you've negotiated it in such a way that in fact you're not going to cheat on it, or you're going to cheat outside the rules of the agreement, so you'll stick to the agreement. And the negotiations were very tough. I know in one of the U.S.-Soviet agreements, there was great negotiation over how you would measure a vehicle leaving a plant, and the agreement was on a yardstick. You couldn't use a tape measure. It had to be this specified, because it might serve some other purpose if it was something else. So unannounced inspections were thought to be impossible. After we did it, and everyone became convinced that was the only way you would find anything in Iraq, even the attitude of the IAEA with regard to Iraq and unannounced inspections changed. Mm-hmm. It was just not politically possible to say you would only do announcements.
In this same report to the Security Council, Blix indicated that intelligence was also an absolute essential.
And boy, did he change his tune later.
I'm just wondering, because this was dependent to a certain extent on UNSCOM. This is a hypothetical question based on your experience. Now we have a situation where, in fact, the IAEA has returned to what you might call a normal inspection mm-hmm. procedure, and there is no UNMOVIC.
Yet.
So, I mean, is it realistic to think that IAEA can maintain on its own a permanent monitoring system in Iraq?
Not if you mean an effective permanent monitoring system. I mean, it can be very much like the monitor. Most people have forgotten the largest on-site inspection program, semi-permanent, was supposed to be for an unspecified time, was in the Rhineland between the two world wars, in which there were well over 1,000 on-site inspectors. Now, it was ineffective because the Allies, the French and the Germans, at a point decided, although they knew what the French and the Brits, they knew what the Germans were doing, their governments didn't want to
confront when the Germans remilitarized.
That's right. And so you have, well, the remilitarization started much more slowly. I mean, it was, and the inspectors chose to only go where the Germans told them they could go. So you can have a permanent, but a false, not effective security without, no, Blitz was right in that report, without intelligence, or if you prefer the less politically explosive term in the UN, access to information, you're not going to be able to.
He used the word intelligence.
He did in that report. He subsequently changed it to information, which is, you know, politically correct, and I have no problem with it. I mean, good intelligence is information.
But so much was dependent on that came basically through UNSCOM.
Absolutely.
That I just wondered.
Yeah, no, that was it. It came, well, it came through UNSCOM, but it also came from member states. Later in the process, there was this division between UNSCOM and the IAEA, and the perception that the IAEA was not as vigorous, rigorous as UNSCOM led to a feeling, and I think it was based on reality, that in the latter stages, not as much was given to the IAEA as to UNSCOM. That was a feeling in the early days, which I think was incorrect, but gradually there did become a feeling that the IAEA just was not as dedicated to pursuing. There were a couple of flaps. Severo was made a few mistakes and turned a lot of people around, and this was after I left, and I think there probably was some drying up. I worry now about whether Imovec, as is created, in fact, is going to get access to that sort of information. Blix, in his public statements at least, has spoken as if he's going to try to do it entirely on the resources of the UN.
Yes.
Testing just to see if this is okay. Now, where were we?
with regard to invoices.
Right, from foreign companies.
In every case that I personally know of, the direction actually came from national governments who said, go talk to those companies, look at them. In the cases where we tried to approach the companies directly without going through the national governments, the companies essentially told us to pound sand. They weren't going to cooperate.
But this kind of information was useful to you when it got to the teams?
It was extremely valuable.
Yeah, yeah. Because you could confront the Iraqis, right?
Because often the Iraqis would say, first, if they didn't know you had that information, they'd say they never had anything. If they thought you had some of it, they would say they had the amount they thought you knew about, and if you knew a different amount, you could confront them with that. So it was a constant cat and mouse game on that score. It was very valuable to have real information.
Now, in these relatively early inspections that you were involved in, did this already involve some destruction or removal of the nuclear fuel?
In the early days, it was the identification of where the fuel was. The Iraqis, and I don't know whether it was brave or foolhardy, actually under attack had removed fuel. They had removed it without detection by the United States or coalition partners. The U.S. had no idea where it was. The Iraqis were convinced, we convinced them of the necessity of taking us to where it was. They'd moved it out to a field near Tawaitha. They had moved it, and they were stored literally in 55-gallon drums that they had managed to weld and fix in a way to store it. Very unsafe, but to their credit, they had done it. So I was involved in the negotiations as to how we were going to get that out of the country. Security Council, if you read 687, everyone was in favor of removing it. if you actually talk to individual countries about whether they would like to take it into their own country, and this includes the United States, none of them wanted to have anything to do with it because of the domestic political issue of moving material, nuclear material, into the country. And so pretty early on, it became clear that the only country that would respond to the issue of you can make money doing this were the Russians. For the right amount of money, it will take anything, as far as I could tell. And so, it became an issue there. The Brits and the French, a consortium, tried to put up a deal, but it was outrageously expensive. The Russians would do it, and they'd do it cheap compared to what, everyone else. Because everyone else had to struggle with environmental protection laws and all of these issues. It made it really, and commercially, the material was not valuable, and in fact, it would have been difficult for the commercial process to handle, so they priced it fully. So we early on identified that. The other things we destroyed when we were there were relatively small items during my inspections. We found a number of the centrifuge parts, which were highly machined material. While we counted them and photographed them and brought them under control, there were a number that we actually destroyed because we were afraid that we would lose control of them. After we left, we put seals on them before we could move them. And so we scratched them and otherwise crunched them.
Now, again, as far as I could tell in reading through very quickly these voluminous reports, actually, while the nuclear inspections went on for a good many years, it struck me that a great deal of the information was obtained in the first four or five inspections.
Oh, I think so.
Was that your impression?
That's my impression.
Yeah.
I noticed one of the questions refers to the chicken farm raid. Now, that was not nuclear material, nuclear data. That dealt with the biological weapons program. No, virtually, there were some, but no, that's right, later. It'll go to voicemail. Some of the material was related, but principally it was the first. By the time you reach mid-1992, we'd had almost all the information we were going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some significant exceptions, but the bulk of it.
The last question I'll put to you this afternoon is the extent of destruction that you witnessed brought by Desert Storm. How effective was the bombing in terms of nuclear installations, at least?
Not as effective as I had thought, and I think the reason for that is a lot of the facilities were not known to be nuclear. They were known to be suspicious sites, and so it was sort of a once-over quickly. The exception was Tuwaitha. Tuwaitha was a known nuclear site. It was heavily bombed throughout the war. The destruction, the sites, the targets that were targeted was good. But there were other sites. Alathir, which was a major site, a real surprise. It had had an elaborate deception campaign run by the Iraqis, which made it look like it was still under construction when in fact it was not under construction. The bombing, they did not even bomb the principal building because of this deception plan. The planners looked at it and said, it's still under construction, not worth waiting a bomb. So instead they bombed the cafeteria and they bombed some of the storage buildings. Now what they hit they destroyed, but they didn't do a significant amount of damage to the site. If it hadn't been for the inspections, and subsequently that site was blown up by the inspection teams, or by the Iraqis under direction of the inspection teams, to be absolutely correct, that site could have easily been back in production. Tarmia, which was the Calutron plant, was heavily destroyed. It was a bit difficult at times to make a fine assessment because the Iraqis had a habit of, if they thought a site was going to be inspected, they went in often and tore down buildings that had not been bombed, but before the inspectors could get to them. They did this both at Tuwaitha. A major Calutron building was destroyed not by the bombs but by the Iraqis. And you know this because we compared gun footage to afterwards. The same thing was true at Tarmia. It was also true at a number of the other sites. So, but on the whole, it was not as devastating as I thought it would be.
So, I'm putting words in your mouth now, but this would seem to lead to the conclusion that intrusive inspections are going to continue to be extremely important.
Oh, I think so. No, I think absolutely true. The lesson I came out is, although the military likes to think that they can destroy things, the fact is they are as dependent on intelligence as inspectors are on intelligence. You can't destroy what you haven't identified. And the lack of destruction in the Iraqi program was because it hadn't been associated with a nuclear program, and so it wasn't bombed. I think without intrusive inspections, without people on the ground who are free to move around, and it's not just being on the ground, it's that intrusiveness is necessary, you're not going to be able to get it.
I said final, but I just have one more question. How would you characterize the competence of the people you were working with in the IAEA side of the inspections?
As in most groups, it varied from some people who were extremely competent, committed, hardworking, to others who were not as competent. And it really was less the competence issue. I mean, in some ways, you self-selected people who were afraid of the danger. I had inspectors, safeguards inspectors, who I asked if they would join us to go on, who said they wouldn't, it was too dangerous. That's all right. That's a human choice. Some people are happy with running risks, some aren't. The real issue was the difference of belief in the appropriateness of the mission. There were some inspectors and some IA officials who thought we were unfairly targeting the Iraqis because, after all, the Israelis had a nuclear program. What were you doing about that? And that's part of the international culture. You're dealing with people who are from all over the world. There were some who were extremely disturbed at the idea of viewed as a U.S.-led operation in the war, attacking a third world state and destroying it. It became more serious the longer the inspections carried out. I remember after the third inspection, when I was in New York to brief the Security Council, I got on, remember how small the elevators are in the Secretary building? I mean, they're always designed so if there's an Israeli and an Arab in it, they have to bump into each other even if they don't have to talk. Well, I was squeezed in one, and there was someone who recognized me from UNHCR, I think it was, and immediately lit into me for the deaths and destruction I was causing to Iraqi children. And, you know, my reaction is, look, I got a mission, I'm doing what I am. But I recognize that in the culture of the UN, and, you know, I'd spent my PhD was written on, my dissertation's written on the UN. Virtually everything I'd published was about the UN. I spent most of my adult life in the UN culture. I knew it. Is that what we were doing was countercultural. Most of the people who were attracted to UN service were attracted either because it was a better job than they'd ever get at home, and that was a few of them, or more widely because of the mission. Mm-hmm. You believed in the goals, you wanted to improve the world, you realized how much human suffering there was, and sanctions which were intimately associated with the inspection process, and the Iraqis used that against us. It meant that there were some people who were less than fully dedicated to what you were doing. We tried to keep those away I tried to keep them as far away from the IAEA missions I was leading, but there were some. Well,
I think that was true in the Secretariat in New York also.
Yeah, I just had to be. I mean, I argued, for example, I remember I argued with ACAS even a couple of years ago, as recently as that. I thought we should end inspection. We should end sanctions. I thought we should put an offer on the table that the Iraqis agree to X and we'll end sanctions. If you don't agree to X, we will commence military action up to a certain level, but we're not going to reimpose sanctions again. I mean, everything I know about sanctions And I know more, what I know about third, I spent most of my life in the third world running around on missions, is governments know how to manipulate sanctions or anything else to their own advantage. It's not going to hurt the party or the officials or the army. It'll hurt the people who don't have access to it. And so it, I said, it was within the first 3 months, I said, look, we've got to move as fast as we can, because I never thought we'd be politically able to keep sanctions on that as long as we have. And I really didn't think we should, because you get the point where they're doing more damage. There is no democracy, no possibility of a democracy without a middle class. And the first people that are hurt, in Iraq I saw it, the first people who were hurt by sanctions were the unpolitical middle class. And you destroy that, and all you do is strengthen Saddam's hands. He knows how to deal with the rabble of the street and mobilize it. It's the middle class that is the threat to someone like that. And sanctions are the enemy of the middle class. I'm still troubled. I'm very conflicted, because I understand that sanctions, when the U.S. and its allies decided that they were not willing to take significant military action again, all the inspectors ever had were sanctions. That's the only tool you had. And so you didn't want to give up that tool, but that was a very inelegant tool for what we were doing, and one that ultimately cut against, I think, political settlement. So, I mean, let's get that off my chest. I am disturbed terribly by how Saddam has used sanctions to destroy his only political opposition.
And certainly insofar as the nuclear side is concerned, the work was, let's say, done pretty much.
It was done to the extent that we'd taken the immediate prospects of a program away from him.
Yeah.
Intrusive inspections have to continue, because in the technical development of a nuclear program, the only choke point is nuclear material. When we started, the Soviet Union existed as a Soviet Union, but with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and consequently in 1981, when Saddam started his second phase of his nuclear program, he had to produce that material himself. In the 1990s and beyond, it became possible for Saddam and anyone else to think they might buy that material out of a collapsed Russia, and hence not have all the signatures of large plants and all. So you really needed you actually needed more intrusive inspection. We need more intrusive inspections now than we needed when we ended the war for that issue, because you can't be sure if you get some material, they know how to make it into a weapon.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Actually, I'm especially interested in the